Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome you here to Mississippi College School of Law and to this wonderful opportunity to hear this court in action. Thank you so much for coming here today. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. DeSico, the clerk of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, for this very special event.
Thank you, Gene. Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. The case you will hear today, United States versus Harrell, is an actual case that is pending in our court. Obviously, it's a case out of the Air Force, and the Air Force judge advocates here will argue it. Also, there will be two law students arguing as amicus curiae from each side. Before we get into the arguments, we're going to have a few bar admissions. A few people are going to be admitted to the bar of our court. Following that, the order of oral arguments, just so you understand how this will work. Each side is allotted 30 minutes to argue. The appellant will argue first. They have reserved 5 minutes of their time for rebuttal, so they will argue for 25 minutes. The students supporting the appellant will then argue for 10 minutes. Following that, the government will argue for 30 minutes, followed by the students supporting the government for 10 minutes, followed by the appellant's 5 minutes of rebuttal. So all tolls can take about 80 minutes of time. Following the oral argument, the judges will remain in place and we'll hold a question and answer session. So if you have questions about the court, its jurisdiction, practice, personal questions about the judges and why they're interested in being judges, or whatever you want to ask them, it's fine. Their only restriction is that they will not answer questions about the case you just heard, because that will be under submission with the court, and they will not address those questions. So, photography, normally the court is not allowed, but it will be allowed for this hearing. If you want to take pictures, I would ask if you do take some pictures, that you do so at the very beginning of a person's argument or at the very end, and not take it throughout, because that could get distracting to the judges. During the question and answer session, you knock yourself out and take all your please make sure your cell phones, pagers, electronic devices are turned off during the hearing, because that can be a distraction too. Any questions about the hearing?
I believe you also indicated that we could ask questions of the counsel.
Yes, thank you for the reminder. You may want to ask counsel questions about how they prepare for oral argument, what they do, how they prepare, and so on. You know, some of you may be out there in a couple of years arguing cases in front of an appellate court, so these are the people you can ask. Maybe get some tips from them. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and begin. All rise. The Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, your moot courtroom at the Mississippi College of Law has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We are delighted to be here, and we are grateful for the law school's gracious hospitality. Before we call our first case, we will recognize Dean Rosenblatt for a motion.
May it please the court, I move the admission of Victoria A. Lowry of Mississippi. I've examined her credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied she possesses the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Your motion is granted. We will also now recognize a member of the court staff, Jim Richardson, for a motion.
May it please the court, I move the admission of Mark Majors of the state of Mississippi and Stanley Harris, also of the state of Mississippi. I would note that Mr. Harris is first assistant United States attorney for this district. I have examined their qualifications on file with the Office of the Clerk, and I am satisfied they possess the qualifications for membership in this court.
Motion is also granted, and we will recognize the Clerk of Court to administer the oath.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America, and that you will conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God?
Congratulations, you join more than 31,000 individuals who have been admitted to the bar and have contributed to the development of the military justice system. We look forward to congratulating you at the conclusion of the hearing. And with that, please be seated. And we will proceed now with the case of United States against Harrow. Counsel for the defense, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges of the court, good afternoon. I'm Captain Christopher Ferretti, and together with Major Anise Barber, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman Basic Ashantia Harrow. This honorable court granted review on four issues, specified two, and ordered oral argument today on three of the granted issues. And with the court's permission, I'd like to spend most of my time today starting with issue one, moving to issue four, and time permitting, address issue three. And I also understand my colleague, Captain Schneider, is going to address issue three as well.
Is that based on your assessment of the strength of each issue from your standpoint?
Yes, Your Honor. It is, to be honest. With respect to the first issue, Airman Harrow was prejudiced in this case because the military judge refused to permit the defense to present extrinsic evidence of prior inconsistent statements of Tony Jackson through the testimony of Special Agent Davenport. This evidence dealt with two primary non-collateral areas of his testimony, and those areas are whether, number one, whether Destiny, the baby, was crying after Airman Harrow left the residence, and secondly, Jackson's differing descriptions of Airman Harrow's interactions with Destiny on the day Destiny was injured. The military judge in this case did not permit this evidence because he was confused as to the law regarding the admissibility of extrinsic evidence of prior inconsistent statements as set forth in Military Rule of Evidence 613 and United States versus Calara. At trial, the defense counsel correctly argued that Jackson's in-court testimony on direct was inconsistent with his prior out-of-court statements to both FBI and AFOSI investigators. However, in this case, the military judge improperly focused on his asserted lack of memory on cross-examination.
Could you first identify the specific inconsistency that you view as at issue between the in-court testimony and the out-of-court statement?
Yes, Your Honor. The specific instance, specific inconsistency deals with whether or not the baby Destiny was crying, and it's a timing issue. Basically, the prior out-of-court inconsistent statement was that Tony Jackson, when interviewed by the FBI and OSI, told them that Destiny was crying after Airman Harrow left the residence. When Mr. Jackson testified in court on direct examination, he testified that the baby was still crying, or he testified that the baby was not crying after Airman Harrow left the residence.
And why is that of significance in this case?
It's significant on a number of levels, Your Honor, but and it actually gets to the prejudice in this case, but because the defense was unable to present the extrinsic evidence that Tony Jackson had previously said Destiny was crying after Airman Harrow left the residence, they were unable to do a number of things, but they were, first and foremost, they were unable to contradict the expert opinion from Dr. Cooper later on regarding the timing of the onset of the symptoms that the baby experienced in this case. And that was crucial in this case because of the timing issue here. The timing was crucial in this case. Every minute was argued extensively, and the defense was unable to contradict Dr. Cooper's opinion regarding the onset of these symptoms. And frankly, that calls into question her testimony, because she was essentially basing her testimony upon what Mr. Jackson was.
How important is Mr. Jackson's credibility in this case?
It's extremely important, Your Honor. Because of the posture of this case, both sides came in. Either side's theory of this case was that, well, the government's theory was that that Airman Harrow committed the murder, and the defense theory was that Mr. Jackson committed the murder, so his credibility was absolutely paramount.
Can I ask one clarification? You said there's one inconsistent statement. Are you arguing one inconsistent statement or more than one?
No, Your Honor, there's more than that, actually. There was testimony, this was in the record at beginning at page 356. There was some testimony that Mr. Jackson testified that after Airman Harrow left the residence, Destiny was not alert, and she was lying motionless on the couch. And again, that's similar to the crying issue, but it's just a discrepancy from what he had told investigators prior to that. And additionally, there was a statement from Mr. Jackson to Special Agent Davenport in a prior interview in which Mr. Jackson told Agent Davenport that he, after Airman Harrow left, he heard Destiny crying as though she missed her mother.
So your focus on the inconsistent statements is whether the baby was crying or was inert or in some way.
Primarily, Your Honor. Primarily.
What about the flinging versus playing? Is that in play or not, as far as you're
it
concerned?
It is, yes, Your Honor. Indeed, it is. Again, in court, Mr. Jackson painted this picture of Airman Harrow handling the baby in a rough fashion or abusive fashion, and he had described that differently in these prior interviews with the investigators, basically in a more mothering light.
And what is your legal basis as to why these inconsistent statements should have been admitted?
My legal basis, Your Honor, is basically, it's actually, we're relying on United States versus Calara primarily, but also just the simple text of MRE 613B. There is no requirement in the rule. Let me just talk about the drafter's analysis of the rule. The drafter's analysis of MRE 613 observes that the rule does not specify any particular timing for the opportunity for the witness to explain or deny the statement, nor does it specify any particular method to do that. And United States versus Calara also explains that a prior inconsistent statement need not be offered or mentioned during a cross-examination.
Isn't there an issue before you get to the manner of bringing in the inconsistent statement? The government argues that the statement isn't inconsistent. Did the judge get that part right or not, as far as you're concerned?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The government takes the view, in its brief at least, that there is no inconsistent statement at play because the witness said he couldn't remember. Do you care to respond to the government's argument that there's no inconsistent statement at play and therefore you don't get to the issue of how you present the inconsistent statement?
Yes, Your Honor. The government is hung up on Mr. Jackson's answers on cross-examination, which were "I don't remember" type answers. And what we're focused on here is what Mr. Jackson said on direct examination. Primarily, and in fact, one of my main points was that it's important to realize in this case that had there not been a cross-examination at all, the defense's position is that this extrinsic evidence should have been allowed, simply on the basis of what Mr. Jackson said on direct. There was a cross-examination in this case, obviously, and that is, that actually appears to be the source of the military judge's confusion on this issue, and it's sort of prodded by trial counsel in the record. But when Mr. Jackson started answering these questions with, the cross-examination questions with "I don't remember" type answers, that also would have given this military judge an additional reason to allow the defense to present this extrinsic evidence.
Now, if he had said instead in response to questions on cross-examination that, yes, that's inconsistent, you'd agree that there'd be no basis for putting extrinsic evidence in, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you have authority for the proposition that "I don't remember" requires the military judge to allow extrinsic evidence in?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. That's been established in cases. I have two primary cases mentioned in our brief, United States versus D'Amata, Oliveira, and United States versus Rogers, which I think is an Eighth Circuit case. But did you want anything further about the cases, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, I guess my question is just, when he says "I don't remember," is that denying that there's an inconsistency, or is it saying that he doesn't remember?
Well,
because, I mean, you're focusing on what he said on direct, but the question as to whether or not extrinsic evidence comes in is determined not by whether there's an inconsistency at all, but as to whether he refuses to acknowledge the inconsistency, or in some places says that he doesn't remember.
I think I can explain, Your Honor. The issue on the cross with the "I don't remember" answers is the judge misapplied the law because he didn't understand that he could have, in his discretion, allowed that extrinsic evidence to come in if he perceived that this witness was perhaps being evasive or purposely failing to recollect. So that's the part of the law that he didn't even recognize, and that's why we're arguing that he was in error, because he wouldn't even consider there was a basis to get into this evidence or to let this evidence in unless the witness denied it by flat-out denial. That was the only way he was going to let this in.
Are you suggesting that the standard is whether the judge thought he was being evasive as opposed to simply not remembering?
I'm not sure if I'll answer your question correctly, Your Honor, but
well, that's what you seem to just say. I'm just asking.
Yes, Your Honor. It is simply our argument on this point.
What does D'Amata Oliveira say?
D'Amata, Your Honor, if you give me a moment here. Apologize, Your Honor.
I thought the case said that a flat contradiction wasn't necessary, but I don't know that the case got into whether the judge thought he was being evasive or just.
How about is inconsistent with a prior statement is not limited to diametrically opposed answers, but may be found as well in evasive answers, inability to recall, silence, or changes of position. Just to refresh
exactly
your recollection.
Right. That's exactly it.
If he had let it in, if the judge had let it in, what would have gone? It couldn't have been admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, could it?
No, Your Honor.
No, it was hearsay.
It's impeachment, yes, sir.
Yeah, it simply goes to his credibility, right?
That's correct, sir, unless, of course, it was the accused on the stand.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
You don't think that the inconsistencies were brought to the attention of the members on cross-examination by the fact that he was shown the prior statements and that he was asked questions about them? You don't think that they got that?
I don't think, Your Honor, I don't think it went far enough. And the fact of the matter is, we're arguing anyway, that because we view this as sort of a Sixth Amendment issue, and as set out in Davis versus Alaska, it's the fact that our client was not able to fully cross-examine this witness, and including fully cross-examine to include impeachment. They were unable to impeach this witness.
Because they weren't allowed to bring in another witness.
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the Eighth Circuit case, first of all, why would a case from the Eighth Circuit have any bearing on a decision that this court would be making, where we're operating under the military rules of evidence rather than the federal rules of evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we use that as an example in the brief because that seems to be where the weight of the authorities point towards, and perhaps it was just because in United States versus Rogers, they seem to articulate our position well.
Is there a difference between the military rules and the federal rules on this particular point?
As I recall, Your Honor, actually, if you give me a moment, Your Honor, I know there's the history of the rule evolved in different ways for between the military and the federal rules, and
sorry about the language of the rule. Is there a difference in the language of the rule between military rule of evidence 613 and federal rule of evidence 613?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. Okay.
So we have, then what bearing does the Eighth Circuit have on our decision here? Is it binding? Is it persuasive? If it is, if you believe it is persuasive, why? What's in the rationale of that case that we should follow?
I believe it's persuasive, Your Honor. And specifically, what we pulled out of that particular opinion is one of the comments was a statement's inconsistency may be determined from circumstances and is not limited to cases in which diametrically opposite assertions have been made. Thus, inconsistencies may be found.
You keep on using the word may, and in your brief you're suggesting, it seems to me, that whenever someone says that they don't remember, that the military judge must find that there's an inconsistency, and I'm not seeing that either in the language you just cited from the Eighth Circuit or in the case from this court.
Ma'am, primarily we're relying on the first reason why this evidence should have come in, which was it should have come in based on Mr. Jackson's answers on the direct. And
so can you lay out how that would work? Mr. Jackson testifies on direct. You, defense counsel, believe that he said something diametrically opposed in another statement. So how do you see it playing out at that point? Because it's not clear to me.
I think at that point, Your Honor, the counsel has the discretion to decide how best to impeach that witness.
So do you think that you need to ask him about the other statement on cross examination, or can you skip that step and jump right to calling the other witness?
Well, what the rule requires is that the witness be afforded an opportunity to explain or deny.
Okay, and so we're at that step, and you're on cross examination, and he doesn't deny it. And he doesn't agree. He says he doesn't remember.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the cases that you're citing tell us that at that point the judge may find that extrinsic evidence, that he may be impeached. Am I right?
You're right.
But not that he must be. But not that extrinsic evidence must be admitted.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. And then, again, getting back to, I guess our argument on that second point was, again, we recognize that it is more of a discretionary matter for the trial judge based on his or her perceptions about what this witness is. If this witness is being intentionally evasive, then, you know, perhaps the trial judge could recognize that and allow in the extrinsic evidence. But what we're arguing is that this judge did not even understand that concept was out there.
What, taking Judge Ryan's question all the way through, what did the appellant not have the opportunity to put before the members?
Is this, Your Honor, could I, just as going to prejudice again?
You can respond to my question as you wish. If you think it's a prejudice question or a law question, that's your business.
Yes, Your Honor. I think some of the things they were deprived of the opportunity to present, and they, again, in this, in the context of this case where his credibility was so key, Mr. Jackson's credibility was so key, the defense was unable to show that he might have had a motive to fabricate his answer. For example, if the defense could have put in this extrinsic evidence of the crying, that the baby was crying.
The extrinsic evidence in the form of the testimony of the OSI agent or the statement, be very specific here.
The extrinsic
evidence. What physically or orally would they have been presented that they otherwise were not presented with?
They would have heard testimony through Agent Davenport that Mr. Jackson previously told Agent Davenport that Destiny Harrow was crying after Airman Basic Harrow left the residence.
Period, or anything else?
Perhaps they could have tried to enter the written notes into evidence, Your Honor.
And in the absence of that, what were they presented with?
They were presented with a picture of sort of a half of a picture of what occurred.
Were they aware that Jackson ever said the baby was crying when he came out of the bathroom, for example?
Well, they were aware of that, but again, through the cross-examination where Jackson denied remembering, telling the investigators that. And then,
so they were aware through counsel's argument, not through Jackson's words.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, they didn't have any evidence of that, though.
Correct, Your Honor. Exactly. And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. And I remember. The judge actually, at specific points, at least a couple of times during the examination of this witness, cautioned the members specifically that, told the members, instructed them specifically that they could not consider that these statements, if they were out there, actually existed and that they couldn't use them as substantive evidence.
Counsel, we have a situation in which there's pretrial statement that's not admitted, which is inconsistent with a statement that's made at trial, and the question of whether it comes in. Now, you said that if the witness on the stand admits the inconsistency, it doesn't come in. There's no need for it to come in at that point because everybody's in agreement there's an inconsistency before the members. If the person denies it, then it comes in to show the distinction. What we have here is a question of assuming that the witness has said, I don't remember. Why does it make any difference in that case whether it's an intentional evasion or an actual loss of memory? From the perspective of the members and what they know about the case, they're in the same position either way. They either have or they don't have the evidence. So from a point of view of evidentiary policy and the purposes behind Rule 613, why should it make any difference?
Well, Your Honor, in the context of this case, again, I think it was crucial that the appellant, our client, be able to fully cross-examine this particular witness.
That's not my question. My question is, why should it make any difference whether the lack of memory is an intentional evasion or a true lack of memory? The members and the parties are in the same position in either case.
Are you arguing otherwise?
No, Your Honor. No, it does make a difference, Your Honor.
So you would argue that the military judge should determine whether the evasion, or excuse me, whether the lack of memory is an intentional evasion or a true lack of memory?
I think the authority on the law on that point gives the military judge that discretion. And
is that a clear, is there a clear authority on that?
I believe so, sir, and I would have to.
You can address that on rebuttal if you'd like.
Well, would that yes, fall sir. Under the category of equivocation?
It would, yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Again, I think it goes to perception. If this goes to whether the military judge perceives that this witness is equivocating by basically the way this case.
But isn't that the judge determining credibility? He's not, well, you know, in it.
Well, Consul, in the earlier quote that you were relying on from D'Amato Oliveira, where it said that testimony is inconsistent and or could be inconsistent where there are evasive answers, inability to recall, silence, or change of positions. Now, do you need all of those, or are those alternative grounds for establishing inconsistent testimony?
I would argue, Your Honor, that they're alternative grounds. I would think it would be difficult to find a situation where you have all of them together.
So in response to Chief Judge Efron's question, it wouldn't make any difference whether the judge thought they were trying to be evasive or whether the witness basically said, I don't remember. As far as this stated rule is concerned, they would be inconsistent.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I see that your time has expired. You will have an opportunity on rebuttal to address this issue as well as anything that you might briefly want to say on the other issues. Your choice as to how to proceed in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will now hear for counsel for the amicus presenting an argument in support of the appellant's position.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm Captain Alex Schneider, a 30-year student, and I represent the Mississippi College School of Law as amicus curiae on behalf of the appellant, Airman Harrow. I will address issue 3. Simply, the appellant's conviction should be overturned because the military judge abused his discretion by allowing the evidence of prior acts of parental mistreatment to be entered into evidence to show intent. This is because the probative value of that evidence can only be concluded to be low or non-existent because the parental mistreatment committed by the appellant was fundamentally different than the act she was prosecuted for.
Just to be clear then, in concept, you would agree that parental abuse could come in for this purpose, but not this abuse in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Your Honor, therefore, the resulting balance, when you accept that the probity of this evidence is low, could only lead to one conclusion, that the prejudice substantially outweighed its lower non-existent probative value, and therefore the judge erred in admitting the evidence.
This isn't a case where you don't want to let it in because it's too probative. You're saying it's not probative enough.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, this case obviously concerns the intersection of two very important goals in the military justice system. On one hand, defenseless children who are abused or killed by their caregivers must be protected and vindicated. On the other hand, our courts have long noted that evidence used to prove a defendant's bad character is not permitted. The decision this honorable court announces in this case today will delineate the circumstances of when prior acts of parental mistreatment can be entered into evidence to show intent.
You don't think that in this case, counsel, that when one of the alternative theories that appellant proposed is that it was possible that that her daughter had been harmed when she was playing with her, that these prior acts go to show a lack of accident?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the defense counsel articulated accident in trial. However, I do not agree that they do have any probative value on her intent. Your Honor, the specific...
How is intent different than lack of accident? Or is it?
Your Honor, I think it should be looked at differently in this case because the element of Article 118 was that the defendant intended to inflict serious bodily injury. And what was brought...
If it was an accident, then she would not have intended, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how is what I'm asking about different than the intent issue that you would like to talk about?
Well, Your Honor, I think intent requires an affirmative act to do something, and accident would be the absence of intent. I guess conceptually they're related, but one requires an affirmative act, and one requires the absence of affirmative act.
And so I'm asking you why it is that the prior instances of you know, acts that were harmful, intentionally harmful towards her daughter, weren't probative of a lack of, you know, an absence of accident in the case of the death of the daughter.
Your Honor, I think it's because the evidence of the flicking or her complaining about the social cost of motherhood is fundamentally different from the act that the government presented at trial, the theory of the case that she shook her baby and threw her against the wall of the quarters. And it's because of that fundamental difference in the level of scope, nature, and degree of that force, which makes this evidence have little or no probative value.
Well, if her prior acts had that degree of force, that the daughter would have been dead.
Well, Your Honor, I think that...
I mean, is that your argument, that it had to be the same level of force?
No, Your Honor. Substantially similar, Your Honor. First of all, I think those incidents were isolated in nature. They're just one incident. And
We just listed three incidents. Why... why is flicking or biting or jerking not appropriately compared in this case?
Well, Your Honor, what the Rule 404B calls for is to analyze the probative value of that evidence towards the specific element of the offense, intent, and then compare that to the prejudice. And, Your Honor, the flicking, the biting, wholly inappropriate, wholly immature, and in no way justifiable response by the mother to her child's normal actions. However, it does not make it any more or less likely that she intended to kill her baby on the day that she was prosecuted.
Some of those examples specifically. And one of the things that amicus can do for us, particular freedom in a case, not being tied to a client, is to help us with examples that we would use to focus on the boundaries that the judges have talked about. So take something like biting. Is there not a circumstance in which a biting in the case that we have before us could be probative evidence, that is, one leaving deep and lasting lacerations and permanent injury? Where would that stand on the continuum that you're talking about today?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would call for admissibility, because that would have a high probative value that the defendant in that case intended to inflict serious injury on her baby. However, I think Airman Harris testified that there were no bite marks from the bite. Your Honor.
So what is it that we should be looking for in a case of shaken baby? This is not, unfortunately, an unusual circumstance to come before the courts. And so in that instance, what lines, not theories of nature, scope, et cetera, but what lines in terms of evidence and acts and what you would see and have described can help a court define that line that you're talking about?
Your Honor, I think any physical injury, any, for example, the circuit courts of appeals, you know, when there's fractured ribs or when there's any type of bruising or there's any type of unexplained burns, all these types of cases show intent, and the rules in that situation call for admissibility. But, Your Honor.
What about a pattern? Is that relevant or not?
Yeah, absolutely, it would be relevant, Your Honor. But the facts of this case simply don't give rise to a pattern. Three isolated instances don't indicate that the...
How old was the child when the injury occurred?
Your Honor, I do not know.
Five or six months old.
Three instances of that nature in 5 months?
Yes, Your Honor. But
that's not a pattern?
No, Mekas does not concede it's a pattern, Your Honor. I mean, it's inappropriate. However, it has little... Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
You're welcome to finish your answer to the question and make a very brief concluding statement.
Your Honor, I think it has to go with a low level of probable value in comparison with the high level of prejudice that any acts of parental mistreatment. Your Honor, in conclusion, the military judge abused his discretion by allowing such evidence, and the appellant's conviction should be overturned.
Can I ask one more question? Would your analysis vary depending on whether the government's theory or the defense theory was intent or accident, or are they the same?
Your Honor, I think if the defense doesn't put intent or accident into the equation, I think there's authority to support that. It matters less. However, I think, you know, there is clear authority that the prosecution has the right and responsibility to prove every element.
If the defense was accident, would you vary your construct?
Your Honor, I think if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in Old Chief, which evaluated 403, they said that you should evaluate admissibility on this issue, not just specific evidence, but all the circumstances in the case. So you would, in fact, vary your opinion depending
on. Thank you. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, we thank you for your argument. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. My name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, we represent the United States government in this matter. Now, with regards to issue one and the inconsistent statements, the government's position is that Mr. Jackson's inability to recall out-of-court statements did not constitute an inconsistent statement for purposes of impeachment via the extrinsic evidence route.
How do you deal with DeMata then, which specifically refers to inability to recall?
Well, I deal with DeMata and counter that with which the Air Force Corps